Hello and welcome to the BitLife Show. I'm Ryan Fring. How do I normally say this? Hello and welcome to Working Title. I'm Ryan Fring with the BitLife Show. And today we talk to Vinny Bassese about movies.
Oh, you got to meet Vinny. He's amazing.
He's a great director, cinematographer, actor, you know, a little bit of everything in the Midwest here.
I can cut it together. Just start saying words and I will make an opening.
We actually heard about him from a
Excellent.
I know he had produced several commercials with this friend of ours. So we actually finally met him last year. It only took a year to get him up here again. We had a really great talk. He's a really great guy. I can't wait to have him back. It was just kind of like hanging out with your friends. Are you a superhero? Do you have powers? So we talk about Revenant, what's a good movie, some of the work that he's done, indie filmmaking, that type of thing. Vinny Bassese, Jazz Hands. Yeah, well, the last time you were here, you had worked on that short that was it was psychedelic. It was just, you know, really beautiful and well paced. And I remember a lot of the colors and kind of the scenery and the setting. And you know,
that one. I guess I would say what's happened in that area is that particular. I was just the cinematographer on that one, mm-hmm. and that director is gearing up. In theory, trying to work on gearing up for his first feature that he wants to shoot next year. Not next year. It's now this year. We were talking about that last year. So in theory, he wants to shoot a feature in September. So I don't know. We'll see. That's a big jump to go from short to feature. Uh-huh. And not saying that he can't do it, but that's a huge... Mm-hmm. That's a huge deal.
Is this something that you'd get to work with him on?
Yeah. He asked me if I wanted to shoot it again, and I said, nice. Of course, I'm definitely interested. And he's, you know, always got really, really interesting ideas, and I think it'd be fun. It's funny because several people now in the indie film world, I guess I can launch right into this because I've kind of experienced this again just recently. I've talked to a bunch of people about a bunch of indie projects, and while the director of the wheel, he already has some money in the bank for from some investor towards his feature. So he's got part of it down. He's got Great. Maybe like a third of it down. And he's going to work on the rest of this, you know, over the next 6 to 8 months to raise the rest. But a lot of people love to, like, they want to make a film, whether it's a short, or let's say it's a feature. The feature is always the big one. Everyone wants to make a feature, right? I do too.
Yeah, yeah.
And they like, oh, okay, we're going to use these actors, and we're going to get this crew, and, you know, we're going to use this camera, and, you know, and we got our start date. We're going to start shooting on September 1st. And they go, oh, okay, great. Did you have the money for it? No, we don't have that yet. But, like, we got everything else, and we got our start date September 1st. And I always wonder, like, well, how can you have a start date when you don't have the money?
Right.
Or even worse, this is the worst one. Script's almost done, but we're going to start on September 1st. Okay, so, all right, like, just start at the basic. Like,
yeah,
if you don't have
right,
a script,
right.
That's the scariest way to be approached for a film, is to work on a film and for them to not even have the script done, not even have
yeah.
the blueprints of the house done, and they're ready to start hammering nails mm-hmm. into wood just randomly.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, John is not in that situation. His script is done and everything, but several other people have approached me, and they're on whatever draft of the script. I'm like, were you really happy with it? Well, yeah, it's getting there. Well, how can you? Don't, I tell you what, scratch your start date. Scratch mm-hmm. even talking to people about it. Yet, until you are like, okay, I got this script, I am totally dead set, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, now, from a money standpoint, let's say it's a shoestring budget, all right? That's fine, whatever. Whatever it is, have the budget or have the concept of the budget or some semblance of the budget ready to go prior to starting to talk to people. Because if you talk to people right off the bat and you try to get everybody jazzed,
mm-hmm.
and then you don't have enough money to just even start, okay, now you got a little bit of egg on your face, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, okay, we got to push our start date back, and that's not cool. I mean, because
right.
you want to capitalize on all the
right.
energy that you're getting everybody jazzed about
mm-hmm.
so that you can, you know, pull the trigger and on everyone on your start date, because you got the money, you got the script, all those, you know, those two things fell into place.
Right, right. And we work with a lot of people who are raising money, and, you know, when they have these $1 million campaigns, they always have this silent phase where they talk to, you know, all their buddies or all their colleagues or that, where they get a third of it, or, you know, a half of it even, before they even go to the public, or, you know, before they even go to the public, you know, there's another phase, and it seems like they have this ball that they, this rock that they get rolling down a hill, and then they're like, hey, look at this rock rolling down the hill. Do you want to get in on this? And and it seems to work a lot better that way. And that's how Kickstarter, you know, recommends you do it. And how we've seen in these kind of indie fundraising sites as well, where it's like, yeah, get some of this money. Because if people see that other people are invested and care about your movie, then they'll tend to care more, as opposed to, you know, zero of $150,000 and, you know, maybe 7,000 of 100. And you're like, well, doesn't seem very serious.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Again, I totally agree with you. And then this is going to sound like what I'm going to say is like counter to that, but it's not. The other thing is, like, if you say, let's say $150,000 is your budget, and you're like, well, I got $50,000. I have 50, right, of it. So I just need to raise 100 or whatever. Let's say I got $25,000. I need to, you know, raise the rest. Many times what people will do is they won't be able to raise the money, the full amount. Well, I got 25. I can start on 25. And then the rest of the money, it's going to come. I know it's going to come. And invariably it doesn't come.
Right,
and so you start and you get into your production. Mm-hmm. Now you're into it and you've spent the money. You spent 25 and you don't have any money left. And now you're going to everybody and saying, hey, will you work the rest for free, or this, that, and the other thing. That's uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it's very uncomfortable. So, I mean, for me, and I've been there, I've been on these shoots, I've been there when, like, an entire crew mutinied and basically
and made their own film. They're like, we're not getting paid anyway, but we're stuck here, so this is now our horror film.
Yeah, it can get ugly. It can get really ugly, especially because in the indie film world, there's so much, like, trust and goodwill and, you know, sweat equity that's put into it. Everybody's working for, you know, a tenth their rate and blah, 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 and all that stuff. So just what I guess I would say is, I'm not trying to, like, you know, expose advice, but, like, in that regard, is have as much stuff as you can. Because, you know, as an indie filmmaker, you're going to go to these people and ask for favors. You know that. You're going to be beating everybody up in some capacity. And if they're experienced in the indie film world, they know it's coming. Mm-hmm. They expect it. They're waiting for it. Everybody's waiting for it. They're waiting for you to ask them for that favor, and they're waiting for your response to that favor, and it's coming. If you can make that as painless as possible, or at least filled with as much goodwill as possible, then you're going to have that much more success, you know, finishing it out, as opposed to hitting a point in the middle of the film where now people are furious and, you know, your paychecks didn't clear because there is no money, and they all bounced, and oh my God, it's like awful. And and honesty, I would say that's like your biggest friend in the indie film world. That we're like hardcore right in the indie film world talk, which I like, is fun. Like, honesty right up front, because, like, if you say, oh yeah, I'll give you points on the back end and all that, if you're young, you go, ooh, points on the back end. If you're old like me, you go, well, that means no pay.
Right.
Because, I mean, which is fine. It's like, so I'd rather you say no pay.
Right.
And, you know, okay, we can play the game of points on the back end. I'll sign whatever. And that's adorable. You know, okay, we'll do that. But just be honest. Like, say up front, like, look, nobody's going to make anything off of this or whatever. Or I got 20 grand to make this film, and that's what I'm going to do. I just hope you know, pitch in and want to be a part of it. Just be honest, and people will respect you that much for it. If you say, you know, we're going to sell this movie, you know, right away, and I got a distributor lined up and all that stuff, well, now people, like, come to the project. If they're not savvy enough to know that that means no pay, well, now they think, right away they have the attitude, well, this asshole owes me money, right away. Like, I'll work on your problem. You owe me money, dude.
Yeah.
You know, is that any way to start a project
right
off the bat? I mean, just be honest and say, there's nothing, I got nothing, you're either in this for the fun of it and because we're going to light a dude on fire, or we're going to crash a car, whatever it is that we're going to do, get into it for those reasons, you know, or legitimately have 60 grand. mm-hmm. and legitimately pay people $100 a day or whatever is the yeah. rate you're going to be able to pay people right. for 3 weeks or you know whatever that is. But
what I got out of that was that a guy named Vinny said that somebody owed him money and they lit someone on fire and crashed right. a car.
Probably have done all those things. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's you know trust and that. You know, being honest with each other, that's kind of like PA 101. You know, if you don't know, like, go get a box of F-stops.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't stop and say, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And you go look and you're gone for 10 minutes or something, you yeah. know, that's incorrect. You should, you know, admit you don't understand
yeah.
and ask. Because everyone that, you know, the majority of people that we've met and worked with are so great, so honest, so trusting, even to the point where, you know, on set, there's a disagreement. And we figure it out. And then afterwards, you know, you just talk it out, you know, like the best families, the best marriages and relationships do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, that is also what you're saying is the approach for on a larger scale, the indie production world. Because I imagine it gets a little fishy when you get more into, I don't know, we'll just start making stuff up now, but bigger production, you know, Hollywood or anything like that, where, you know, it might just be microcosms of personalities instead of a lot of honesty yeah. and trust and, you know, in the indie world where we're all going to have to carry this on our back. And if we don't all work together and if I'm not honest with you, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to carry as well as you could and we're all going to fall over, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you hook up with a production from out of state, let's say you know somebody's coming here to shoot an indie film or wherever, like here, I don't want to be like, you know, rah-rah Midwest, but kind of rah-rah Midwest because we're all pretty, you know, fairly yeah, honest yeah,
Midwest
here.
Nice.
Yeah, 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 Midwest. And we all like working hard and we like doing cool shit and mm-hmm. seeing cool things happen. And so that's good. But, you know, to just have your, you know, wits about you when it comes to an outside production company coming into town. I don't want to say like everybody's out to screw you, you know, mm-hmm. you know, but in the indie world, oh man, it's tough because it's so tempting to want to, you know, screw the locals or whatever, do whatever, because mm-hmm. they can come in and they can blast out of here. And that's not always the case. I've been a part of indie productions that have come from out of town and were phenomenal to work on. And then I've been part of indie productions where, you know, you sign on, you're reluctant, but your gut is telling you, you know, you tell them, you know, okay, I'll do your project, you know, we'll play cards, but I got to play cards with my hand on my gun with you. That's what I got to do. I got to do it with you because I just don't trust you.
Sure.
And in the Midwest, we got a good, generally speaking, got a pretty good sixth sense mm-hmm. or, you know, gut instinct about who you can trust and who you can't trust. And 9 times out of 10, we end up running circles around. It's been my experience that we run circles around other crews, like people come from the coasts or whatever have come here and have, you know, oh, working with the local yokels and oh yeah, they'll send them to go get a box of F-stops or whatever, blah blah blah, and we end up like totally blowing them away mm-hmm. and working infinitely harder and whatever. They're totally shocked. I got a good story I could tell about that specifically. So nobody. I could use names. Nobody cares. Nobody gives
nobody
a shit.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So okay. So
it's more for us.
What was a guy? Dean Devlin. So he was the producer on like his big claim to fame was Independence Day.
Mm.
And then since then, what he's like currently kind of famous for, but it's old, is what's that Timothy Hutton series, Leverage? Right? Is that it? I think on. Okay, Leverage. That's kind of his baby. So he comes to town, this is a long, long time ago, and he was going to shoot a trailer for a movie that he was trying to sell to Warner Brothers or whatever, trying to get them to pick up, about a stunt pilot, I think. And his big investor was, what's the guy that owns Oracle? Larry somebody? His son, whoever that is, his son.
Larry Page?
Whoever owns Oracle.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's Larry somebody. His okay. son, whatever, right? Rich kid. And so that kid was going to team up with Dean Devlin, and they were going to shoot a movie about a stunt pilot or whatever. So they came here to shoot at the EAA. So they hired a local crew. I was one of them to be their crew to go up and shoot like all these different, you know, planes and the air show and all tons of shit that they were going to put into their trailer, right? So the Steadicam operator that came from L.A., we were doing a scene. He, you know, he could tell he had an attitude. A bunch, couple of these guys, you know, they had their attitudes.
Like attitude, like ego, like
yeah, you ego, know, like cute little like Wisconsin yeah. dude. Yeah. You're in the, you think you're in the movie business? Yeah. Well, you can come and tote my shit, yeah. right? So okay, you know, whatever. But we, you know, we just did our jobs and we were all the grip crew and we were doing everything to the best that we could and we knew right away we were impressing them because. We were working our asses off and doing a great job. So comes time to do a Steadicam shot where the guy wanted to be, you know, flying down a row of planes or whatever. And we had a gator. And so he was going to ride in the back of the gator. And I guess I was going to, like, hold him. I was going to be a safety. And Tom Matthews, who you guys know, more than likely, I would imagine, he was driving the gator. And so we get in the gator and we do the shot. And everything is fine. It's perfect. Guy turned on. Yeah, it was very good. All right, let's do that again. All right, we go do it again. Perfect. Totally fine. Yeah, great. Okay. We're about to do it again, and then Dean comes over and says, hey, can I ride with you? I want to see what you guys are picking up. And the Steadicam goes, oh, sure, yeah. And then suddenly, like, his chest all beefed out. Now, Dean Devlin's here. The producer's here. You know, and he's worked with him before, so this is his guy. He came from LA with him. So but he has to, you know, put on a show. So we go do the shot. Identical, 100% exactly the same way. Get to the end of the shot. The Steadicam guy starts bitching his head off, literally about nothing, but yelling at Tom Matthews, who was driving it, like, ah, yeah, keep it straight. Tom did the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing was different. But he had to yell at the local guy in order to make himself feel that much more impressive to Dean. Oh, this guy's, right, you know, he's treating these local guys, shaping them up or whatever the bullshit was, right? So we get done, we keep our mouth shut. Tommy and I look at each other, we're rolling our eyes. We get back to the grip truck, and we're unloading a bunch of our gear. And another buddy of mine, Don, is in the back of the grip truck. We're handing stuff up to him. And he's like, oh, how'd it go? And Tommy and I are you know, yeah, it went pretty good. He went, okay. He's like, you know, was there any problem? I'm like, no. Steadicam guy's a typical LA douchebag. And Don, like, as he's listening to me, right, he's listening to me, and, like, maybe I'm halfway through the sentence of, you know, typical LA douchebag. He, like, looks up, and I see his eyes get real big. And then he kind of comes back to me as he has stuff up, and then he whispers, behind you. And I'm like, oh, I don't give a fuck. And that dude didn't say shit to us. For the rest of the day, he was respectful. He was nice. He was peaches and cream. Didn't matter if Dean Devlin was around or not.
Yeah.
So he heard all that. And that was like the one time me, this little guy.
You,
like,
well,
kid.
You and you reminded him. Like, yeah. You can't be douching other people.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You're a douchebag, and I don't give a fuck if you heard me. So that was good. That was good. That was like, you know, I felt like, that was a win
vindicated.
For, yeah, yeah, vindicated. Like, you're not going to come to this town and treat us like shit. We're not just going to roll over and take it.
Right.
I think, especially in the Midwest, for those who are less experienced, the problem or the trap that people fall into is that we're making movies. Like, we're doing fun things here. We're just kind of doing something fun and creative. You know, and so, like, yeah, there's not a much pay and whatever, and we're all going to work long. But, like, people fall into the trap of not treating it like a business. Like, no, this is a business world. Like, no, you want me to be here. I'm doing my job, and you need to pay me this, you know, X amount or whatever's agreed upon. And sometimes in this industry, maybe more concessions are made, but still it's a business. And still, it doesn't, just because we're doing something fun doesn't mean that we don't treat it like that.
Mm-hmm. With a beautiful, wonderful story. blessing and a curse, you know, everyone, you get into it, varying levels of experience, and lots of people want to jump on and help out, especially for free, with little experience. And I think the challenge is just finding people who can work hard, Because I think, you know, any level of experience, you can start working on any productions, but you have to be able to work hard and want to learn and want to grow. If you think, you know, you're the shit, and, you know, even if you've been on only a few productions, you know, if you're not going to work hard, that's one of the things that we look at when we're looking at PAs and grips and that type of thing. Not somebody who knows everything, because mm-hmm. Certainly we don't know everything and how to, you know, call everything, and we're learning stuff every shoot. But somebody who's going to work hard, going to be there, going to be ready. And I think when you have that on an indie set, that's also going to be a way that you can succeed. You know, it's a sign of success mm-hmm. when you can find hard workers willing to work on this project for little money.
Yeah, throw a rock in this state, you'll hit one, though. I mean, because everybody here is, I mean, I shouldn't say everybody, but like most people have great attitudes and are, you know, really mm-hmm. fired up to work on indie projects and everything. And that's awesome. That's great. I mean, I love it. I wouldn't live anywhere else.
Now, how long have you kind of been doing indie production as well as professional production? Like, what's a little bit of your story? Us that.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate it. I've never stopped, I guess. Right, in film school, right? I guess you can call it indie production, right? Because you're out there, you're working on it with your friends for free. And I've never stopped from that moment on. Actually, going all the way back, obviously, to high school. Yeah, when you're shooting shit with your friends in high mm-hmm. school. To now, I still will get together and work on indie projects for either very little pay or nothing. If it's for friends and stuff like that, you mm-hmm. know. I scratch a lot of backs so that I can get mine scratched when the time, you know, comes.
Yeah, right.
So that's part of it, especially with the community in the state or in Madison, I'm sure, and in Milwaukee. So there's a lot of that goodwill. So I don't mm-hmm. I don't really stop at it. And there's people like that are in the business, and we might have talked about that at that event where, like, you know, they're like, well, how can you get together like on the weekend and do your job for free? I don't mm-hmm. get that. Like, don't you do it during the week and you get paid? And then why would you go and waste your time? Because there's just, you know, you're either doing that stuff to keep your creative soul alive and all the fun that comes with that. But then other people do these jobs just because they're their jobs and that's it. And they're not really interested in the extracurriculars. And that's totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is kind of weird. It's like, you probably wouldn't catch, although maybe, like, would a plumber go out and plumb for free on the weekends on plumbing projects? No, probably not. I don't know. It's probably one of the
if so, rare call aspects. Me. Yeah. I have some things that need to be fixed that sound stupid, but I'd like somebody to fix for free.
I'm looking for a plumber to work on a creative plumbing
exactly,
project.
Exactly, that's it. It's artistic, so no pay.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, running a business, I think the most frustrating thing for me is just trying to organize and, you know, kind of on the front end, shift things around from multiple projects and that and schedule. And, you know, we have Julia who produces and schedules and does all that. But even just looking at my schedule, I'll see, ooh, creative thing, you know, like shoot something, come up with creative, do, you know, some kind of mood board or whatever. And I see that on a schedule and I'm like, ah, I don't want to do that. But the second I'm in there, you know, it's all kittens.
Yeah.
The same thing like on the weekends, like, oh, we got this, you know, 48-hour film contest or this puppet film, you know, another weekend of that. Oh, okay. Got to prepare. And it's just this weird mental game that I enter into where I just have to stave off, I don't know, like the desire to not work long enough so that I can actually get into it. Cause I love it. I love the creative, the work and, you know, just being in that mindset as well. I mean, even here, just being able to talk and, you know, that type of thing. Like I see it on the calendar week after week and it's like, oh, 3 hours. I got a lot to do, you know, try to figure those things out. But as soon as you're here, you're like, yes, this is where I should be. This is what I should be doing.
Yeah.
So that's tough for me.
Keeping the creative soul alive is part of it too, because I think in the business world, like, you're dealing with clients who don't always, you know, are a little concerned about going too far, too, you know, weird or whatever, too goofy, and they want to play it safe, and you push to a certain extent and then you just back off and be like, okay, fine, let's do it your way.
Yeah.
And eventually that's not very what's the word I'm looking for?
Satisfying?
It's not very satisfying to frequently have your ideas just like, okay, we'll do the thing that's a little less.
Sure.
And so if you're not getting that, you know, and if you want to push yourself a little bit or try something new, like you've got to do it separately. You got to do it on the weekend. You got to, you know.
Yeah, it's the best time for you to experiment.
Yeah.
Well, and then when you experiment, you just are, not only you're pushing yourself and you're growing and stuff, but then you can bring all those new ideas back to the client world, and then, you know, 80% of them don't fly, but then sometimes 20% poke through and you're able to actually do a whatever, a time lapse or a bullet timer or this or that, or whatever it is that you've played with on the weekend that you've kind of got down pat, mastered. And, you know, there, it's not, you know, there are the clients out there that do want something new or want something, or at the very least, they say that up front, and then you get to the edit, and then they kind of like, whoa.
Yeah.
But usually still you can poke some stuff through. Right. And that's cool, you know, when you can. Again, and at the end of the day, you're trying to sell, you know, their widget or their service or whatever it is. But if you can, you have to do whatever you're going to do to maintain your own, to flex the creative wings as much as you can, because that's the only way you're going to be any good at what you do. And that's the only way the client's going to end up wanting to work with you in the end, is because you do cool shit. They appreciate your work. They like what they see, you know? Stagnation is, that's death.
Well, and it's interesting too, because like when we, you know, I don't know, early 2000, when we, well, late early 2000, I don't know how to talk about the aughts now. But when we kind of came into the field professionally, there was this transition still happening to HD and digital and that type of thing. And you know, this weird, like, well, we haven't done this for 30 years. You know, we've kind of done the same thing for 20 or 30 years. Now we're changing. And now it seems like, you know, we're changing almost every year, or, you know, if we're not changing, we're dying. And it seems like over the last 10 years with YouTube and online video that there's been a large shift in how we tell stories, certainly. And I know that we found that a lot of our clients are open to that thing. You know, like, I don't know what that thing is, but I want that thing.
Yeah.
And so they've been a lot more open to things that we pitch them. Like, hey, one we're working on now, their competitor released scientific testing video that showed our product versus their product. And even like to us, aside from the quality, you know, how terrible it was, you know, can't believe they put that out there as marketing.
Sure.
But then the science of the scientific testing, we're like, just turn the fan to the left. Like it's not even in the right area.
Yeah.
Like you can see that. And, you know, like when they're moving something down, you're like, why is that off to the side? This doesn't make any sense. And then, so our client, you know, was offended by that and was like, well, we have to refute all these points. And especially the engineers, they're like, this is wrong. We have to fix. And we're like, okay. All right. What if instead of entering into this playground fight where they say, no, your hat's stupid. And we say, no, your hat's stupid. And then they reply, your hat's stupid. And then I reply, your hat, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of that, like, let's take the high ground. Let's do something silly. Let's say something about your brand and keep it kind of in that competitive nature without really, you know, talking about this competitor.
Yeah.
So we actually pitched them a kind of Dollar Shave Club walking through the warehouse type of flippant energy and things happening and scientific testing video.
That's
with
cool.
an actor and, you know, completely scripted and storyboarded and, you know, plotted out. And it's turning out really well. But we were just excited that this kind of more, you know, more standard style of company, we create Widget X. We sell Widget X, and here's how we get our margins, and et cetera, is open to let's do something interesting that'll be shareable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone's like, can you do the viral? Can you do the, you know? We're like, well, I can tell you what's not going to be.
Yeah.
This stuff over here, but this stuff over here has a chance. Yeah. I don't know. Let's take a chance over here.
Yeah, that's the worst question in the world. Make me a viral video. Oh, okay, if we knew how to do that, right? I mean, of course, that's... That's always true. But I mean, you hope, you have no idea what's going to catch fire, of course.
We, I mean, I've heard some cliche phrases maybe, but I think they're useful. And like the one is like, well, I can't guarantee a video is going to be viral, but I can guarantee a video that won't be viral. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can guarantee that if you do it this way, nobody's going to care.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in it, the reason that it's kind of fun to be in like business and corporate production now is because of like the modern audience and their tastes and their like patience with watching advertising has gone way down. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of makes it fun because we get to toe that line toward more creative, more film, you know, making, storytelling, which for some reason that word is like grinding on me lately because I hear it all the time, like stories, we're telling stories, but
yeah,
but it's true, whatever. And so now that audiences are wanting to consume what they want to watch and can skip anything that's advertising, now the advertising can become more like filmmaking. And that's, mm-hmm. that's what we try to do. We do the fun things, we do the creative things, but we're trying more and more with anything else to just be like, don't do it that way. No one will care about your widget. All they care about is being entertained or, you know, feeling something, like, yeah. you know, connecting. And so that's yeah. been fun for us.
Yeah. I the thing that I'm probably interested in myself, if I had to kind of say what I push for myself now is, I don't want to say not so much the entertainment thing, but like what I'll try and push clients on is to be memorable. So really make something that's going to stick in somebody's memory. And in order to do that, you have to separate yourself from the noise, which is mm-hmm. tons and tons of noise out there. So, you know, I like to say, okay, so let's take a look at, you know, whatever. Let's say that we have a series of concepts here for your commercial or your video or whatever. Now let's just look at these and let's just be honest. What's noise and what's not? What has the potential? What has the potential to not be noise? What concept can we drive past and make somebody who's going to be, you know, washing the dishes in the other room prick their ear up and look at the TV or something or whatever, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to just be the droning, you know, on of everything else.
Yeah,
that's kind of that's what my I'm currently probably been in the last like. Couple years now been pushing for is sticking in the craw of mm-hmm. somebody, and I that's not always you're not always saying well you have to be entertaining to do that no not necessarily mm-hmm. I mean you have to be in the end you'll be entertaining because you're memorable right mm-hmm. but it has to be whatever it has to be punchy or sad or something or striking or whatever
right,
it is
right.
you know what is what you haven't seen if you look at everything that's out there right now let's go in this other direction mm-hmm. you know comment on the Revenant so I saw it and it's
which I haven't seen John has seen it yeah. so it's I'm third party
I won't ruin it
I've seen it three times
okay so that's interesting so okay I because I'd be curious I'd like to hear your thoughts on it because for me it was, I mean, it's really good, right? It's really, it's a friend of mine, a producer, he actually phrased it best when it comes to what it was, that filmmaking. It was majestic filmmaking. That is a great, like he had said that to me and then I went and saw it and I'm like, wow, I can't really phrase it any better than that. Mm-hmm. It was very, it was mm-hmm. majestic. And there's a lot of fantastic, you know, photography, and there's some really great performances and stuff in it. But, you know, for me, which is interesting, like, that's a movie that, like, I probably won't see that again for probably a very long time. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's kind of, it's not exactly like this, but it's a little bit in the vein of, like, a Schindler's List. Like, you see Schindler's List, and you're like, If you've seen it, it's like, wow, holy shit, that this is powerful. This is incredible filmmaking that I probably don't need to watch again for a very, very long time because it's hard. It's hard to take it. Now, Revenant's not like that. It's not that, you know, hard intense. Like Schindler's List.
Yeah.
But it's long and it's one of those things where, like, I'm like, okay, I don't necessarily need to see it again. Whereas for me, if I walk into a room, and I think this is the same for a lot of people, if I walk into a room, I don't care what point, if television's on, I don't care what point Goodfellas is on, you will sit and watch it to the end.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, that is a movie that will grab you and demand you sit and watch it. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. Revenant, it's not going to demand. Maybe I'll watch the bear fight again. You know.
Maybe it'll turn out different this time. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know.
That's the future of
And obviously, you know, you've heard all about that.
Oh, yeah.
And you've heard. So I'm gonna complain about one thing that it's not going to ruin it for you because you already know about the bear fight and you know about stuff. But this is interesting. Maybe I'd be curious to talk about this. For me, when you're watching, I'm so jaded. Like, the bear fight is great and the way they do it is great and Leonardo DiCaprio is great and stuff. But, you know, the first moment that when it gives it away that it's a digital bear, right? The first moment is like, for me, that takes me out of the movie. Yeah. Like, I stop, like, okay, it's just a digital bear, which I knew. I always knew. I knew going into the movie it was a digital bear, but I was rooting that it wouldn't stop the movie for me and take me out. Now, it's really good. It's probably the best digital bear you're going to see, right? Next to that bear in that commercial, that's the rug. Did you see the bear in the commercial where the bear is directing the commercial? And you haven't seen that one?
No.
Oh.
Is it one that where he takes a coat off?
He says, boom, explosion, boom. Now you haven't seen that? I'll send you the link.
Yes.
Maybe you can link also, to I like it in that this
there's,
podcast.
There's another bear commercial.
There's a different one.
Is this the one? I've seen the one where there's a bear rug that like talks or something.
Yeah. I'm going to send. Yeah. The bear. Okay. I'll send you that. Yeah. You can link to it if you want.
We'll put it down
You'll
here.
Love it.
Where's Jeff?
But the bear in this is fantastic. No question, it's great. But the buffalo. Now, when it gets to the scene, there's a big buffalo. There's a scene where there's buffalo. I'm not ruining anything. It's a movie shot up north, wherever. Right? There's going to be buffalo. But they get to the buffalo, and they have to do a thing with the buffalo. And if you were the filmmaker, if you were, I'm going to try and say his name right, Iñárritu. I think that's how you say it.
Iñárritu?
Oh, that sounds terrible. I like mine better, Iñárritu. Anyway, you know, he would say, like, what? These buffalo, how the hell am I going to do buffalo? I have to do digital buffalo. Do you see where I am? You see where we're shooting all this crap? Okay, where am I going to get buffalo? It's got to be digital buffalo. Okay, fine. A little movie for you. What's it called, though? Dances with Wolves. Yeah, I got news for you. You don't have to use digital buffalo. They had That's to. Right. Maybe where That's they were right. shooting, there was no buffalo, and Dances with Wolves went and shot. Okay, whatever. I'm just saying to you, the texture and reality that is the buffalo in Dances with Wolves is not what you get in The Revenant. And for me, it stops the movie, and I'm like, now I don't believe anything I'm seeing.
Sure.
I know he's looking at nothing.
Right.
And it just, I got to wait till the CGI moment is done with.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. And I'm probably too harsh. I'm way too harsh because CGI is such a, there's great CGI and there's wonderful CGI. And then there's CGI that like, it doesn't allow you to care as much.
Right.
I'd rather see a puppet. I'd rather see something you could, you know, feel or whatever.
Well, and are we enhancing? Or are we just replacing? You know, because there is that kind of tipping point where it feels like a cheap replacement. And certainly, you know, new Star Wars, which we'll just touch a little bit on maybe and go back, new Star Wars CG versus 1, 2, and 3, certainly we've advanced in, 11 years or, no. When is the first one?
What, 90, early, 99 or 98 was Phantom Menace,
okay.
right? Something like that.
Yeah.
99.
So 17 years or so.
Yeah.
Certainly there's been advancements, but even in the original film, you know, the use of miniatures and then, you know, painting on film cells and doing crazy things with film cells, like when we couldn't do it all practical, I think that that'll still be, at least a strong approach for a long time for things like this, because in Revenant, they're like, it's this beautiful nature, no lighting, you know, totally natural. We just, you know, ran around and captured it all. You know, there's that kind of sell that it's just going to be real.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it is a little inside baseball, but that's our lives where you're like, nope. Peek behind the curtain, where, you know, regular people might not notice it. But in this case, for us, it doesn't enhance to know these things.
I feel like I may have noticed in the buffalo scene. I didn't notice with the bear. But what was interesting was my perception just knowing logically that it wasn't real, mm-hmm. and knowing that it would be impossible to have a real bear do what was in the scene was enough to unfortunately pull me out slightly, because it was just it was like that story. You can't even show it. You just can't. I know it's not like, I just logically can't find myself in a place where I know that this visual is actually happening.
Yeah.
And it was enough to be like, this is intense and really, you know, I felt like it was really realistic, at least in that moment, you know, I mean, it's also really hard in a movie like that where you are saying that this is all natural, and anything that's out of place, we're so perceptive just with our human eyes, we can just notice these tiny little things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I could make a movie and have, you know, intend this, but as soon as you release into the wild, it's something else, you know? There's a lot of those kind of cult classics that fail in the box office, but then, you know, 5 years, 10 years later, they're discovered and they become something completely different, you know?
Yeah.
And one could hope that anything you do is mildly successful to start and just keeps getting more successful. But, you know, if it doesn't hit right, it doesn't mean, you know, your efforts are wasted. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be discouraging, you know, in art and creation and that type of creation. But in the creative fields, where if you throw something out there and it doesn't stick, you're like, dang, I can't do that again. But, you know, maybe the time wasn't right, or, you know, the target wasn't right, or any number of things. And if you can stick with it and work hard, you know, I think that you can see it through.
Well, John Carpenter said in an interview not too long ago that he was really frustrated with filmmaking and was contemplating giving it up. Or he says, I always contemplate giving it up because he goes, I'm tired of making cult hits. And by that, he goes, I'm not trying to have an ego here. He goes, but I want my movie to like be good right off the bat.
Yeah,
I don't want to wait 10 years for somebody to come around and then they say, well, they love it. Now a whole bunch of people love it. As a filmmaker, you want to hit right off the bat. And I have had such a string of cult hits. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly frustrating. Right. I never really thought of it like that. Like, he's right. Wow, but he makes awesome shit. I think it's fantastic. But I always I came to it later too. You know, for the most part, I wasn't seeing his early movies in the theater, you know. So I don't know. I can see where that would be totally frustrating. It'd be great if, like, one of your movies, like, you did a movie and, like, it didn't get any praise. And then you had a string of successful movies. And then later, a movie you're like, everybody loves It's a Wonderful Life or whatever. Like, all those movies that were shit when they came out with Wizard of Oz or whatever that everybody hated.
Right.
And they only came to later to love it.
Yeah, well, and Damn it.
Which one? What? Who's in it?
Let's see. I don't even know where I was going to go. With a cult classic, John Carpenter.
Starship Troopers.
Oh, my gosh. Which
Guilty
I love.
Pleasure. Guilty pleasure.
I love. And my wife loves it. And, I mean, it's such a, you know, sign of the times. And where was it? In Denmark or, you know, one of those. Because it's...
Yeah,
it's,
Paul Verhoeven's Danish.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, director.
So they, like, banned it, you know, for the longest time.
Yeah.
There.
Or some,
because it was, you know, it was a political statement.
Yeah.
About the government. Cult classic.
Acting is terrible.
On the flip side.
Yeah.
We have M. Night Shyamalan.
Okay.
Who, you know, met with early success and thoughtful in this and, you know, does a thing two or three times, but then everyone's like, nope, we're wise. We're wise to the thing.
Yeah.
And we don't care, you know, what the movie's about, because you're going to do the thing. And we're already over the thing. So he's on the other side where he was, you know, kind of a hit right away. And now he's trying to come around. And what's the movie that he just did?
I don't know. What I mean, he hasn't.
With like the kids. Did you see it? Horrible. Is it any good? Dang it. I'm hoping he can come out of it because, you know, all that good stuff.
Whatever it is that he's doing. His first movie is great. Mm. And then I personally didn't like any of them after that. And you're kind of like, are you a one-trick pony? Is that it? That's your shtick. You're doing your shtick.
Right, right, exactly.
And your shtick is just not as good as the first time you did your shtick. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he came out with a movie that was great and it was a shtick, but it was great again, that'd be one thing.
Are you saying The Last Airbender is not good either? Is that?
I'm probably saying that. I'll draw a line in the sand and stand on that
I think
side.
Everyone will stand with you on that side.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, but, you know, it's challenging. And I think that's that's a world that, you know, critic acclaim and reviews and feedback, which, you know, I don't know. Have you had any of that with work that you've done that's challenged you?
Nothing's critically acclaimed, I'll tell you that much.
You know, or, I mean, no. Kind of tough reviews or, you know, something that you felt really solid about that
sure.
came back.
And, oh, yeah, you get that. And you have to have that. That's great. Well, you know, I might have mentioned this the last time that we talked about the indie stuff that I've done personally. The guy that writes it, you know, he at the very end of the day, he just wants the praise and, oh, it was great and did a great job and, oh, it looks great or whatever. But that's what he's after. Mm-hmm. That's what he's after. And he just wants to hear that. And all your friends and your relatives, they're going to tell you that. Doesn't matter if it's shit. They're going to say that to you, you know. And he eats that up. And he delusionally thinks that it is good then.
Yeah.
Maybe some part of him realizes it's not completely true. But then, and then he has his group of friends that he does respect and whatever. But like for me, it's great. I love, who doesn't like to hear praise? Everybody likes to hear praise and get a pat on the back and everything. That's wonderful. But I know I don't grow as an artist unless I find out like what people didn't like. Mm-hmm. Like what didn't work for you. I mean, and I'm not trying to say, he's like, well, you're trying to, you push negative thoughts into people. You say, what you didn't like? Now they got to think of something they didn't like and they got to make something in their head that they didn't like. I'm like, well, okay, I'll say it a different way. You know, did anything not work for you or what wasn't as successful or whatever? Right. Those are the things I'm more interested in. If somebody says, oh my God, it was a home run right out of the gate. Everything worked for me. Well, that's great. I'm a little suspect of that. Yeah. But,
and for the most part, you have to take that gracefully too.
Yeah.
You're like, thank you.
And for the most part in person, like if you're sitting in front of them, it's just not, you know, common courtesy to like, well, what'd you think?
Yeah.
Well, here's what I thought was wrong with it. You know, so unless you invite that in person, no one's going to do it.
Well,
unless you find it
people
like.
People rarely do invite it. And that's why I try to invite it. And I try to get to a point where I'm like, listen, I'm glad you liked it overall or whatever. But I'm just curious. I'm really curious about like at any one point, did you get taken out of the piece or did you think this or did you think that or, you know, did the digital buffalo really bother you? You know, whatever the case is.
Yeah.
You know, how else do you learn?
Right.
I mean, if you just keep getting praised, I don't know. I just don't think there's that much growth in that.
Right. Yeah. Well, and certainly, you know, people do believe that. There are people, and certainly with the family thing, I'm going to say certainly a few more times, but with the family thing, anytime I do work, my mom and, you know, family, it's like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's so good. And I'm like, thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
But I'm like, yeah, really? You know, this happened and that happened. I would totally do this different. And, you know, you're always kind of revisionist history type of thing with it. But then to be able to talk with, you know, a colleague or a peer or something like that, I think there's a, you know, right place and a right time. And that's when, you know, criticism is going to be really strong. Because even, you know, just somebody who doesn't do this, you know, they can certainly have an opinion and it's very valid. And it tells you what that person thinks about it. But then to talk to other people, you know, like, yeah, this shot was really kind of wonky. Like, what happened there? And you're like, yeah, you know, XYZ. Or I thought it was really good. Thank you for the feedback, you know. And, and we've kind of become a culture of everything's great. You think it's great. I'm great. You're great. Whatever you're doing is great.
Yeah.
And we've kind of lost that, you know, that ability to criticize gracefully. And,
well, and then other people would say... to the counter to that, because again, I'm not saying any of my viewpoints are, oh, this is the way it is. No, like other people would say, well, as an artist or an artiste, right, you should be able to make your painting. Now, I don't give a fuck if you don't like the red, the shade of red that I used in my painting. I'm using it, and there it is. Now it exists, and now it's out in the world. And that's fine. You can do that. That's free will, right? But like for
and about 98% of you won't be working.
I like to ask, like, I get a focus group together. Do you guys like that red or do you not like that red or whatever?
Yeah.
I like to get an interesting opinion on people because I value people's opinions and stuff like that. I am interested. And then there are filmmakers that are not interested in really in people's opinions.
Right.
And they'll do great work. There's, you know, right? There's people out there that'll do fantastic work regardless of what kind of feedback they're getting. So there's no one right way. It's whatever is working for you, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, I went to school a little bit for 1 year in Milwaukee.
Oh, really?
Film program there and then came here for film. radio, film, and television. So you get a little bit of everything.
Sure.
In some production. But anyway, sorry, I keep touching the mic. Lot of art. Mm-hmm. For art's sake there. And kind of what that taught me is, you know, it's totally valid to just make shit and throw it out into the world. You know, a lot of people aren't going to be okay with shit being thrown in their direction.
Yeah.
Some people are going to love it. I didn't see that I could make a living throwing shit into the crowds of people. And so I kind of, you know, took the slightly more corporate route of, you know, be happy and content with how hard you work and the art that you create, but certainly be open to the feedback and open to growing. Because I feel like some of that art is like, no, this is perfect for when I was there and how I was there. And, you know, I don't care about anybody's feedback. And, you know, that happens. There's a few people in the world who can do that, and that's great. But for the rest of us schmucks, you know, we have to figure out how can we actually appeal? You know, how can we do something good for the world in a way that we can do it, you know, because maybe there's three people that can do it that way, and that's good for the world. And that's, you know, what are your goals?
Yeah.
Like art for art's sake, art for society's sake, art for my family's, you know, like what am I doing and why am I doing it?
Yeah.
It's an important question.
Yeah. Milwaukee was a good school, I mean, for that, to raise a lot of those. I mean, they pushed, their film program pushed it as art very much so. And they were of the mindset, you know, if you're trying to get a job in filmmaking, leave now, go to a different school. This isn't the school for you. We're not teaching you how to get a job. Mm-hmm. We're teaching how to create art. That was their standpoint for a long time. It's since I think changed to a certain degree. And that's good. And you know, with it, like I was of the mindset, no, I need to work. I need to get a job. I got to make a living when I come out of here. So one way or another, you people are going to teach me how to make a living. You know, somebody's going to teach me how to make a living. And they did. And the art and the avant-garde aspects of that taught me independent filmmaking. So that taught me independence and how to do, because as an avant-garde filmmaker, you are kind of doing almost everything on your own. You have to learn how to do the sound and the camera and the lights and every single thing on your own.
Right.
And what that translated to was a really good education at independent filmmaking. So it was wonderful for a lot of those reasons, even though I myself wasn't an avant-garde filmmaker.
Right.
And it's listed in the top 10 film schools in the United States because of that, because if you are into that, you do want to go there.
Right.
They're heralded. But I would also argue that inadvertently they teach you some of the best independent filmmaking methods and practices that are around.
Well, and certainly approaching problems from completely different angles that you never would have thought before. Mm-hmm. You know, here's your assignment, tell a story about this. And that was actually something very valuable, to see the range of things that can be created. You know, as opposed to if you gave that to, you know, a lot of working professionals, the range would probably be a lot more narrow.
Yeah.
And certainly being exposed to that art. So again, you know, the point of that art, maybe it's to encourage us and, you know, help us to do more creative work in the world as well, you know.
Did you get to cut on film?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So I love that.
Yeah.
And we did that here, I think, my first year too.
We did that here.
But I love that. And I loved kind of a lot of the getting into filmmaking classes. And then there was kind of a lot of preening for certain types of work.
Sure.
That just wasn't my cup of tea. That kind of led me away.
Yeah, the cutting on film, I think, is fantastic. If you can do it, if you can go to a school that will still have film, I would highly, highly recommend it, just because there is, you know, when you're cutting on film, there is so much importance put on that edit. Because when you cut that film, you are cutting a physical thing. And if you don't make that cut,
there's no control Z.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's none. Well, there is, but it comes at a price.
Right.
So let's say, you know, you're editing your film and your Steenbeck or your rewinds or whatever, and you realize, you know, I have to make a cut here. I have to make an edit. Okay. Well, I think it should happen right here on this frame. This is the frame, I think. And then I look at the other one and the other frame, and yeah, that should work. Okay. You cut, you tape splice it together, you play it. Oh, it works. That's great. You tape splice it together. Oh, it doesn't work. okay, well, I'll take it apart, pull the tape off, put it together, add in that frame back, you know, okay, put more tape on that, and then I'll cut two more, three things down.
Yeah, right.
Does that work? Oh, fuck. Now, okay, take this one. By the time you're done,
create a little.
It's so thick,
yeah,
with tape
exactly
on it, that now you risk it getting stuck in the projector and melting when you're showing it in class.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much on the line with the image. Like, and you'll have tape. I remember we had tape splices. You know, you'd have your film is like going along and like, you know, you were like noodling it left and right. And sometimes it would get stuck and you'd be sitting there watching your film praying it would just make it through the projection system. Mm-hmm. Who does that now? What schools do you pray it makes it through the projection system? It just, there. I'm not disparaging that. I'm just saying, wow, what a great thing to have to learn a respect for that edit, for, mm-hmm. you know, for you to really focus on, is this the right place? And I'm not trying to say this is what you should do on everything. And there's, you know, phenomenal abilities to be able to play with nonlinear. Great, of course. But still apply thought and care to what you're doing and really think about the edit. If you really think about that cut, you're going to care that much more about what it is you're doing. And I think you're going to invest so much of yourself more into it, which mm-hmm. in the end shows up on the screen, in my opinion.
Well, and I think that goes to, you know, like with shooting, cinematography, directing, they always say, you know, they think like or direct or shoot like an editor, not shoot like an editor, think like an editor when you're shooting or directing and things like that. How's this going to work with the next piece? And how's it all going to cut together? You know, is it going to work? That was an abject lesson right away with film. Like, do I really need six angles of this one little scene that's very insignificant?
Yeah.
Likewise, how can I make this interesting because I only want to do two angles?
Yeah.
You know, like there's got to be more energy, more action in the actual scene going on because I'm not going to cut really fast because this is, you know, this is my second project with film and I don't want to, you know, fall prey to the mistakes last time where you know, lots of cuts and we had problems with it and it came apart and, you know,
we're
trying to minimize that and still tell a solid story. So
thinking
like an editor again as well.
Well, it's making choices, like making critical choices, as opposed to like not making choices. Your example is reminding me of this photographer, and I don't remember his name or what he did.
Dude,
you know what he worked
so
for.
So smart right now, if you remember.
I know, but he was like a maybe National Geographic, or you know, like did a lot of work, and he decided he wanted to challenge himself and go on this trip and take one photo a day.
Digitally.
He had digital, but he was forcing himself to take one photo a day because he realized it's just like snapping photos like crazy all day long and you're not making any decisions and you're not like having to force something. And I was like, wow, that's a really interesting, you know, challenge. Like you have the sunrise.
Which moment?
Yeah.
This is a great sunrise. Hopefully nothing else comes up today that I want to, you know, and similar making that choice of like editing and like, where am I going to cut and like putting the weight of what that means to make this decision right now. And that, yeah, you can kind of go back, but it's not going to be very easy and you're going to start risking things. Mm-hmm. And so making that decision just have more weight versus just like, well, it's just kind of cutting it. Okay. Never mind. Let's just go back. Whatever.
Yeah.
Like, or, well, just shoot it all. Just shoot it all. Shoot it all day long.
Yeah.
Take. Well, let's get more B-roll. Get, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
just keep doing it. Keep grinding away.
You know, and that gets like not only physically but also mentally exhausting. You're just like, I don't know, just another shot. Just, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah, you start to not care. You know, if you care, you know, really draw. Like another thing that's exactly like that is the whole shooting it clean. Now let's shoot it clean because we want to do this in post. We want to do this. Should we use some filtration or should we do something? Nah, let's shoot it clean because we can always do that digitally in post. I hate that. Mm. I cannot stand that. Do I enjoy all the crap you can do in post? Of course I do. I do enjoy that. But at the same time, if you know you want your highlights to bloom or whatever the case is, and you can do it, and it does look different. I don't care what anybody says. There are nuanced differences whether you're using film or digital, when you use a filter
or you
use an old lens with no coating on it or whatever the case is, you see those differences. And you know, can you mimic them? Of course you can. And is my 83-year-old mother going to know the difference? No, she's not going to know the difference. But you know the difference.
Right.
And you can make a stand for what – we just did a series of commercials where the same thing came up. It's like, oh, well, we can use these really nice, pristine Zeiss glass with, you know, great contrast in the coatings. Or we can use, you know, the old lenses. And old lenses are popular now. But we had the option of like, well, let's get the old lenses and let's use the cinematographer, who's a really great guy, and he I don't want to say he's old school, but he likes experimenting with the physicality of the photography. So, you know, he has a whole series of different nettings that he'll experiment with behind the lens. You know, that it puts in between, you know, on the body of the lens and or over the
between,
lens
and between the lens and the sensor.
Yeah, somewhere in there, he's doing it. And different whether you put it on the lens or whether you put it on the camera will yield different results. And he shot a bunch of tests, and we looked at the tests, and we're like, oh yeah, we like that. And it, you know, do you want to do that or do you want to shoot it clean and try to recreate it? No. This looks great. Why would we not do this? Let's do this.
Right.
We know this is going to work and we want that look. Let's do it. And it was great. It turned out awesome. It was fantastic. And you know, when you put things off to post too, because you can do anything in post, many times too, things get lost and you forget what you were going to do, or you're crippled with fear that the client won't like whatever filter you're putting on, your digital filter that you're putting on, you know, and you just don't push things, you know.
Sure.
And so it's like, you know, be messy and be, you know, do all the things that you can do with the art, and you will, you will inevitably fuck things up, and you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to wish, like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have done that stuff. But that's part of the whole process, you know.
Right.
That's part of the game, you know.
And you may never end up with that stuff either, because if you wait till post in case you can, you know, if you want to change it, and then it comes down to that decision making, making the risky decision, and then people just back off, like, no, let's just leave it clean.
Yeah.
And you're like, should have just done this on set. Yeah. So that you'd be like, well, this is how we shot it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can kind of force them. You can't say, oh, this is what we got.
And frankly, how are you going to, you know, push your skill and your understanding of the tools that you're using to the limit without doing that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how are you not going to know what a lens flare, how it's going to behave with this filter or with this lens or with this net on the back or the front? And, you know, because you're like, yeah, we could just throw flares on the highlights and post, and, you know, you could do any of that. But to be able to play around with that, you can, you know, okay, well, this series of lenses does this, you know, this series of lenses does this, this sensor does this, this, you know, how you're not going to figure that out if you're just shoot it all clean. Well, the latest digital whatever is probably going to be pretty clean, and you could just do that for everything, you know.
Well, and not only that, but you'll be, your product, I'll say product or art, will be better in the end because you're investing, like, because you pick the lenses and the filtration and whatever up front because you feel it's going to serve the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what lenses, camera package, whatever, what digital technological tools are going to help me tell this story best and really play well? Not just, I'm not going to choose them just for the sake of choosing them. It's fun, you know. You know, you choose it because in this moment, wow, that look will tell this moment of this story really greatly, or I need the whole thing has to have this wash or this feel or whatever the case is. Start out early, and then you can nurture that look all along through post because you started there, as opposed to just waiting to the very end and then just clicking through plugins.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right, and often, you know, different people are doing, managing the look at different stages, right?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, on set versus an intermediate versus, you know, your actual edit or things like that. So I think you can always or often tell when care has been taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can feel it. Like you said with the highlights or something like that. You know, grandma might not know. The general public might not know. But, you know, I guarantee that people might be able to tell a difference. People could tell a difference, you know, when you are trying and being thoughtful and being very particular about the things that you select versus, I don't know, just give us the best digital clear, you know, clean image, and they'll do something in post.
They can tell when you A-B it, usually, between, if you were to say, here's what I did, you know, with these set of tools, and then here's what we did without these set of tools or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's at that point that my mother can go, oh, yeah, I can tell a difference, you know.
Right, right.
And then when she, you know, when she can tell a difference, she can have an opinion on it one way or another. But if you just give her, the product in the end.
Right.
That is another thing too that that people keep reminding me that that is it is true, and it's good to remember. But I mean, just it's not good to remember, like, oh, so that you can police yourself all the time about it. But you know, in the end, people are only going to know, like, what you show them, right? Mm-hmm. They're only going to see, they won't see the options unless you show them the options. Mm-hmm. So they'll never know what that previous edit was like unless they're given the chance to make that choice. Again, another reason for doing focus groups or whatever, showing it to your buddies or whomever and showing them two different options or talking it or opening a dialogue about it, mm-hmm. So that you can get people's opinions on stuff. Because if they don't, they just get what they get and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And they either like it or they don't. So.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. It's, you know, it's a bit of a gamble. You're like, I have this great idea. See it through with me. And you can convince people, you know, but then see it through and put it out into the world. And you're like, oh no, our assumptions. But, you know, hopefully if you're able to keep working, you have a good attitude, you know, you're trustworthy, you're open with the people you're working with, and you're not, you know, crazy egotistical. And, you know, even if this one doesn't land, you did have something that worked, and people hire you back or work with you again, and, you know, keep trucking.
I have another anecdote kind of on that I could bring up that I found fascinating when I heard it. I really recommend doing this, which is taking your DVDs of your movies or television shows or what have you, rip the director's commentary tracks or producer to actors, rip any of the commentary tracks off. You can do it for like $30 with software online. It's easy to figure out. Rip them, turn them into MP3s or AAC files, and put them on your phone. Nobody really has iPods anymore so much. Put them on your phone and listen to them as you walk the dog or as you bike or as you're in your car trip driving up north for a shoot for 5 hours. Whatever it is, where you're going, I'm telling you, it's awesome. I've always wanted to listen to commentary tracks. But you never do.
Right.
Rarely do you ever really sit and watch a movie with the whole commentary track. And I've always meant to do it. And finally, I figured out a way. I was like, I got to be able to do this without watching the movie when I'm, you know, just walking the dog, just thinking or whatever. And it's easy. It's easy to do.
And it works?
Oh, yeah. It's awesome. It's nice. Fantastic. You can do it. It's super easy. I can tell you how afterward would be boring to talk about it right now. But you rip it, and then it's like you're getting like this fantastic film school from like the masters.
Oh.
Right? Because they just sit and talk to you and tell you how they did their shit. And it's great. And you can, and if you know the movie really well, mm-hmm. you know what part they're talking about.
Sure.
And you can always hear the movie in the background playing. It's awesome. There was a thing from Francis Ford Coppola on the commentary track from Apocalypse Now, I just learned, that was pretty neat. It was kind of neat. And it's kind of in a little similar vein of what you were just talking about to a certain degree. So it has to do with continuity, right? So many people are like, you know, obsessed with continuity errors and, you know, so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
And that's important, right, to a certain degree. But Francis Ford Coppola, he said out of necessity, he came up with a new way to address continuity, which he calls matching upwards. He says, I match upwards from now on. Once I learned this on Apocalypse Now, from that moment on, I matched upwards. And what that means is it goes back to, if you remember Apocalypse Now, the scene with where they're storming the beach with the helicopters, mm-hmm. and the Cry of the Valkyrie music is playing or whatever, if that's what it's called. You know, dun, 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 right? That whole scene that is spectacular, that's heralded as, you know, one of cinema's great war moments,
mm-hmm.
right? The helicopters are storming the beach, the helicopters land, and everybody's getting off, and Martin Sheen is part of that brigade that gets off, and he's having his battle and fighting, everybody's fighting, right? So on and so forth. Well, at one point, Martin Sheen tripped and fell, and this, I learned this in the commentary track, it's the only place I've ever heard it, tripped and fell on his gun, and it cut his nose, or his face, I think, right here. And they were like, oh, well, you know, holy shit, what are we going to do? You know, they had to put a Band-Aid on it. It was a deep enough cut where it had to be bandaged. They couldn't just put makeup on or prosthetic. They didn't have the ability to do it out there in the field. And they had to have this Band-Aid on it, and they had to keep shooting. And they're like, this, we're, you know, you know, we're ruined. How are we going to do this or whatever, blah, blah. Francis Ford Coppola is like, you know, well, we're going to keep shooting. You're going to keep shooting? You can't. The continuity would be all off. You can't have a Band-Aid on his face in one scene, you know, and then he gets to the beach, there's no Band-Aid, and he finishes out the rest of the scene, but there's a Band-Aid. And Francis Ford Coppola's like, well, what are we going to do? Let it heal? Sit here and let it heal? We can't do that. No, we're going to keep on shooting, and we're just going to match upwards. Everything from this moment on, in the story, he's going to have a Band-Aid at this moment on, and it'll be okay. We will justify it. We'll work it out through the edit. We're going to match upwards. Nice. And they did that. And when you watch the movie, at least for me, I've never questioned it, ever. Yeah. Because the way they edited that scene, it's like, here's the attack, and everybody's running around, and you're not necessarily following Martin Sheen throughout the whole thing. You know, you're not. You cut away to other time ellipses, and there's other moments and stuff like that, and you come back to him, and he's got this Band-Aid, and you just...
You allow
number
it.
One, you don't even think about it, but if you were to think about it for a second, you would say... Oh, well, he's in war.
Sure.
Something hit him. Absolutely. He ran up to a medic, and a medic saw the Band-Aid. I mean, right? You don't even think of it for a second. But they were freaking out about it while they were shooting it. Never a problem. Never a problem at all. And I thought, well, that is super cool. So commentary tracks.
Good.
You can learn something
from
them for sure.
Good. Well, we should wrap it up. I know we just lost that camera. That means we've been going for about an hour and a half, which is fun because I feel like we've just gotten into it. So now, the next time, we'll start off right where we left off. We're still recording over here and there.
It was a lot of fun. I'll say this. Thank you so much for coming. Oh, man, we could go on and on. You know, just get a pizza, throw a pizza down here, we'll keep talking.
We'll do that next time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very cool. Thank you very much.
And if you are open, you know, to a little bit longer format, we try to keep it to maybe around an hour. Just, you know, we're sitting here, we're talking, but, you know, we could always talk all day about things.
Sure.
So,
well, maybe you should wait until the reviews come in because they're like, that little guy was not very interesting.
Our one friend and my mom will be like, great job, guys.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I'll show it to my mom, too. She'll watch 2 minutes of it.
We'll have several moms.
And then she'll say, do I have to hit a like button?
Yeah.
There, I'm done.
You're like, you've told me all this.
Yeah.
Like, subscribe, do the thing. So thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you. It's an honor. I'm so glad that you guys asked in the first place.
Yeah.
Seriously, this is a lot of fun. I had a blast last time.
Good.
I came up here and talked and stuff. So this was truly an honor.
We'll get you out here quicker than, you know, 1 year.
Time, I appreciate it. No, I really, really appreciate it.
Do you have anything? You said maybe you don't have anything you want to promote, but can people find your work somewhere on the internet?
Yeah, or if they care.
Anything you're really proud of you want people to see?
I guess my work's all at my website, which is bazazi.com. It's just my, you know, commercial reel and some of my narrative stuff, which of course I'm proud of everything I put up there, if you care to. You know, I guess now that you say it, I'm the director of photography on another friend of mine's film, which I guess I can promote. He's also happens to be my cousin, so there's a little bit of nepotism there.
Nice.
Frankie Latina is finishing up a feature that has gotten some very interesting praise, and I'm very excited for that one to come out. And he might be a guy you might want to have on your show. He's a very interesting filmmaker at some point. So
what's this called?
Right now, it's the...
Working
name
title.
Changes, yeah. right now it's called China Test Girls, and it's gonna be pretty interesting. It's shot on Super 16, so from a cinematographer standpoint, I can say it was an absolute joy to be able to touch film again and load a camera mag and all that stuff was an absolute blast, and wouldn't have been able to do it if he hadn't asked me to be a part of his project. So I'm excited about that one. That one should be coming out. It should be hitting the festival circuit this year, 2016, somewhere in there. He'll start his run. So there's that. And then I guess I can suggest two things that if you haven't seen it, and you probably have seen it or whatever, but the two very entertaining things I just re-saw recently. So the Truth in Advertising video on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
That one is awesome. It's a great one to watch. Always the kind of like... distills everything down, which is great. I love to touch base with that one every so often because that's so appropriate about
it. We'll put that down here.
Yeah.
Right there.
Another one I just recently saw that is awesome, is hilarious, is is fairly viral, I think, but is Shit Craigslist Producers Say. Have you seen that one?
Oh, no. I haven't seen the video, but I feel like I've read like a short list of
hilarious
things.
Absolutely hilarious. Watch that one. That 100% deals with what we started talking about in the very beginning of this conversation, mm-hmm. of whatever, about, you know, not being ripped off or whatever, being treated fairly. You should watch Shit Craigslist Producers Say on YouTube. Yeah, if you want to, there you go.
We'll put it down here. Yeah, do the internet thing. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not affiliated with any of those guys. I'm just telling you those are fun things to watch. I'll say a couple things. Another cool thing, website to look at that is really inspiring, inspirational, is one called Art of the Title. I don't know if you guys have seen that website. Art of the Title is a website that all about title sequences, and they take title sequences apart and they, you know, distill them and they interview the people that made them. It's fascinating stuff. It's really, it's cool stuff.
We've kind of gotten into creative titles and with some of the 48 hour films. That's how we brought into this one team. So, I mean, we've certainly had a blast with that. I love it.
They have an awesome archive of titles and everything. It's good stuff.
Nice.
So. Cool. Well, thank you so much again for coming on.
We'll have
all the links down here. Normally, nothing happens normal, except maybe that we have our guests sign us off because we don't have a sign off. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you can. Is that camera going or just this one? Okay, so you can sign us off on that with whatever you want.
I just want to say thank you again. This has been awesome. I can only hope in some way, shape, or form this has been mildly interesting. These two guys have been probably way more interesting, but thank you so much. It's been great to just be a part of this. I look forward to doing it again sometime.
Great.
Boom.
Cheers.
There you go.